This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Manchester United 0, Liverpool 5. That was really something. Not entirely unexpected. In fact, really quite expected. So how then can we make this conversation new? We can't, but still, you can only talk about what's in front of you. Liverpool were brilliant, Mo Salah is brilliant, Manchester United are a really strange thing now. Elsewhere, well done to anyone who can make sense of Everton 2, Watford 5, Chelsea hit 7, and no one's really bothered, not even the team who let them all in. City keep on keeping on, Arsenal play reasonably well, and Yuri Tielemann's strike is still rising. A tale of two banners at Selhurst Park, quick get the police to find out what's really going on, all that plus fantasy football tips, lorries in rivers, familiar toe-sucking your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Joe says, how can we ever decide on the greatest pod lineup when there are so many excellent combinations? How do you fit an Eau Claire in there or a Bandini? Do you have to shoehorn a Bruin in at left mid, even though he's one of the greatest centre mids we've ever had? Peter says, Max, Barry, Wilson and Barney, is this the first team? This is the squad we have for today. Jonathan Wilson, welcome.
Morning, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hi, Max.
And Barney Ronay, hello, mate.
Hello.
Manchester United 0, Liverpool 5. Barney, you were there. You wrote in your report, it seems fair to ask if there has been a worse performance since this club were relegated in the 1970s. It seemed bad from the television, from the armchair. How was it in the stadium?
I suppose the feeling that was a bit surprising was just kind of sadness, really. It was kind of sad. At the beginning, when the teams walked out, I was looking around the stadium and just thinking, wow, it was really loud. Everyone was really excited to be there. It's partly to do with people coming back into stadiums, obviously, but there's this really strong connection at the moment, I think, when I go to games between the people in that physical space and the players. And the people at Old Trafford, it's a real buzz. And I looked around and seen it's this clanky old thing now. Obviously, it's up for redevelopment. But even like the font on the letters on the stand has got this kind of power. It's like an old album cover. I was thinking it's like looking at the Stone Roses album cover or the Rolling Stones. It's got this power, even though it's faded and old looking. And that's what made what happened after that feel particularly sad, because it's kind of related. It feels kind of transgressive, what's happening there. Like, this is not what sport should be. And I've got this kind of thing I always say about football. Like why should we care about this? Why should we care that Man United have a bad manager and they're not particularly good? It's like, there's always this feeling that whatever you chuck at football, it's been so completely mucked around by money and weird things and mad people down the years. At the bottom of it, there's still this like beautifully pure thing, which is competition, and it's ruthless and hard. There's nowhere to hide. It's honest in some way. Even if your team is built out of, governmental money and going to smash the other team 12-0 because you've just got all the better players, there's even an honesty to that. But what's happening there, they found a way to ruin it because it's not honest. It's a heritage project. It's marketing. And there's a guy who, if he was just a random Norwegian guy who'd been at Swansea, his friends in the media would be screaming for him to be sacked. What's going on? Why is this guy in charge of Manchester United? But because there's this emotional and financial and invested personal tie to the recent past, it carries on. And it's like this mobile waxwork museum. Like, clearly on merit, there's a problem with the manager at Manchester United. And you saw it yesterday. The team is just functioning well below what it should be, and maybe that doesn't matter, but the way it's been done and the way it exists just feels very kind of sad, and like something has really gone wrong with how this sport is supposed to work.
Edward says, does Jonathan Wilson think Solskjaer is the man for the job? Does he have any specific feelings about him as a manager?
What can I say that I haven't already said? I don't think he's up to it. I think they have problems pressing. And I think what was really worrying yesterday was that everything fell apart. It wasn't just the press. The first goal is a result of the pressing being wrong. That Greenwood obviously sort of thinks, oh, hang on, some of the talk has been maybe I'm a bit lazy, so I'd better run towards the ball. And by doing that, it means Van Dijk can knock the ball past him to Robertson. Wan-Bissaka's then got a decision to make whether he holds his position or whether he goes. He decides too late to go, and then suddenly Jota's in space behind him, and the whole thing falls apart. But after that, United, I mean, I suppose they did have like that decent spell of 20 minutes after they'd gone 2-0 down. But there were long spells where they just couldn't make simple passes, where you suddenly would have, I think it was the third goal, you had sort of five men went to the ball. And so there was obviously a space in other areas. It was sort of kids in the playground style. It was that bad, that sort of being this great mental collapse that they just suddenly couldn't play. And you know, the red card for Pogba, which was completely correct, but you could see that coming a mile off. I mean, I think Ronaldo should have been sent off at the end of the first half. That Fernandes challenge early in the second half was really bad. You know, it was studs up midway up the shin. It didn't look that bad because the leg was in the air, but that could have been a red card. Maguire could have been a red card when he tugged back. Was it Jota he tugged back on the edge of the box? And he got a yellow for it? Yeah, I think yellow's probably right, but on another day it could have been red. So they could have had three men sent off before the red card happened. It was a complete breakdown of discipline. And of course, Ronaldo's made everything worse. The Solskjaer last year in this type of game was actually quite good. I think the six games against Liverpool, City and Chelsea last season, they kept five clean sheets. But they can't play like that now because they've got Ronaldo. They've got this lumbering figure up front who has to be accommodated, and that causes everything else to break down.
Barry, Ole said, "We've come too far as a group. We're too close to give up now." What close to what precisely?
I'm not sure. It's a bit like Odysseus, you know, on his way home from the Trojan War. And Ollie, I suppose Mike Phelan is his faithful hound Argos, and Michael Carrick is Penelope. But I'm not sure what he's alluding to there. What they're not close to anything. Jonathan described the chain of errors that led to the first goal, and they seem to, every mistake is it's a chain reaction of mistakes that one leads to the next and the next, and then the ball is in the back of the net, and they all seem to emanate from either a unwillingness or a refusal to press. You know, Bruno Fernandes half-heartedly pressing now and again. Mason Greenwood doing the same. Cristiano Ronaldo just doesn't do it. And you kind of wonder, you don't need to be Thomas Tuchel or Jurgen Klopp or Pep Guardiola really to coach players to do that properly. Or if you don't want to do it, do something else. But they're just so easy to play against. And when you look at the fixtures they've coming up, Spurs, Atlanta, Man City, Watford, Villarreal, Chelsea, Arsenal, all those teams, even Watford probably, are just going to be rubbing their hands together with glee. And any team can have an off day, a bad day at the office. And if you're Manchester United and you have it at home against Liverpool, that's bad. But everyone but the most deluded Manchester United fans could see this coming. And Paul Scholes called it correctly on Thursday after their Champions League game. You know, they got away with that one. They won, and it was a great game. But he said, you know, play like that against Liverpool and see what happens. And, well, we saw what happened.
There is a significance, Barney, in this being Liverpool and at Old Trafford and being 5-0. You know, you can lose games significantly, but given that rivalry, it feels to me like this is... If this doesn't end his tenure as manager, then sort of nothing could possibly do.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously traumatic. I think rivalry aside, that the significance of it being Liverpool is that Liverpool have a really coherent team and are brilliantly coached and have a top manager. And in that sense, are kind of everything that this Manchester United team are. I mean, it's just a very strange situation. We're calling for him to be sacked. And it's not like... It's not like it's a disaster. It's just, it's insidious. And there's a feeling that it's so obviously just off. Solskjaer, weirdly, he reminds me of sort of late Arsene Wenger right now. But without, it's like a Wenger who hadn't won all that stuff and had done nothing. They just brought in the late Wenger who was failing and confused. And you could see things going wrong, but there was always a feeling it might get better and we really like this guy. But he hasn't actually done any Wenger things to kind of merit that. He's just, I mean, weirdly, I think he was quite a good manager during the pandemic. His whole method is about feelings, and it's vibes, and everyone feels good, and we all like each other, and we get on the coach together, and it's fine, and we're happy. And that he was like a wellness guru or something, just someone who's going to make you feel nice. And that really worked when there were no fans, and it was really weird, and the players probably felt weird, and everything felt horrible going to games. And he was like this friendly guy and a familiar face. And that was a successful way of managing during sort of grim lockdown times. But the lack of detail is not just the sort of pressing thing, which is kind of everyone picks up on the telly. They're just standing in the wrong places. And there's no, if you think, do you remember Tuchel solved this problem in one training session before his first game against Wolves? You know, there was a 0-0 draw, but they were incredibly solid, and suddenly everyone was standing in the right place. And that was fine. It took one training session of him saying, no, you go there. And suddenly they, you know, 7 clean sheets in 9 games, whatever that was. So I don't think it's that difficult if you're a good manager.
Wilson, who do you get as manager? If Solskjaer goes, and you know that there is a possibility there's an international break, as you say, you could let him limp on till they lose to City. Who would you get, and what would they have to do? You know, should you get rid of Paul Pogba because, you know, he can be brilliant, but he can do what he did at the weekend? Do you need somebody who can be brave enough not to just do whatever Ronaldo wants?
Well, Ronaldo's the biggest problem. But in terms of who they get, I mean, who's realistically available? Conte. I mean, there's really nobody else who you could just get straight away who is there. I mean, I suppose they could look at Newcastle's shortlist, increasingly long shortlist, and get some ideas. So Lucien Favre, for instance, I believe he's still out of work, if he actually exists. But yeah, Conte is the obvious one. And I know there's this sort of feeling with Conte of, oh, you know, he will leave sort of a toxic legacy. You know, he comes in, he's sort of a souped-up modern Mourinho. He comes in, he shakes everybody up, he wins something, then he disappears, and there's a bit of a mess. But yeah, United are in a position now where they haven't won the league for 8 years. It's going to be 9. And they've just sort of become a team who don't even look like league winners. They look a level off. So they need something, a major shock. The other thing you could do is wait and hope that Pochettino becomes available. But you know, how can you wait? It's just going to drift on.
But there is also, Max, there's a very good chance they'll win their next game, which is Spurs away.
Oh, absolutely. You know? I mean, I watched Tottenham, and trust me, watching that game at midnight was pretty depressing, but we'll get on to that.
So, they, you know, say they win that and then they beat Atalanta away. Is he back in favour again? Then City comes up and they get a gobbing off City at Old Trafford. You know, it could rumble on for a very long time.
With City, I wonder if it becomes a bit... You know when you're playing cricket and you realise the opposition's got a really crap leg spinner, and so you think, well, I'll just help myself to 6 and over off him. I'm not going to smash him for 20 because then they'll take him off. So maybe City will think, you know, well, we'll just beat him 2-0 and that'll be enough that he won't get sacked.
Do you think Liverpool did that yesterday? Because they could have won by a lot more.
Do you think this whole discussion is like this is an example of why unhappiness is so much more interesting? We haven't actually mentioned Liverpool. They haven't lost since April. Like, they're amazing. And Mo Salah is the best player in the world.
I don't think they actually played that well.
But they didn't have to. Scored the same goal 4 times. It just ran straight through the middle.
In the same way that, you know, a really strong man can't prove he's strong against an open door. Yeah, I think it is quite hard to play really well against an opposition self-destructing like that.
But it's not just that game, though, is it?
No. They clearly are really, really good. And I have some reservations defensively about them, but going forward, they're sensational at the minute.
Jordan Henderson's pass. For
the fifth goal, man. Yeah, absolutely beautiful pass.
Oh, that was just something else, man.
But that pass also came from he had so much time. Like, professional footballers are really good at football. Like, there was no one near him. He's like, okay, we're 4-0 up. I'm going to do that pass.
But didn't he have to win the ball off Paul Pogba? Or was Pogba?
Yeah, he just walked straight through Pogba. And then there was just all this time where he thought, I'm going to do one of those brilliant passes. The ones you do with a tennis ball when you're just playing in the hallway. You know, it was like, it was a real piss take of a pass.
You were the one, Barney, who said we should talk about Liverpool, and then you kept saying every Liverpool goal was because they just had so much time and so much space to do whatever they wanted to.
Yeah, but they did do it, and they have been doing it for a while. I mean, they're really good. They're kind of in that they've gone full Liverpool again, and look like they could just win a lot of games.
Question from John: after spending £995 on a rug, has Wilson developed any sympathy for Manchester United's foolhardy purchase of an expensive luxury they didn't need? Etienne saying, like many young players, Curtis Jones probably admired CR7 throughout his childhood. By which childhood hero would you like to get kicked in the guts? David says, should the Sky Sports director get a BAFTA for best cinematography when they cut to Fergie looking fed up and then to Dalgleish laughing his head off? It was absolutely brilliant, wasn't it?
Sorry, two things. The rug was €995, not £995, just to be clear.
Okay.
And also, I do not regret that purchase at all. The rug is, it works. It's a good rug. It's made that area of the room much cosier. It really blends well with the chairs. It's one of the best €995 I've ever spent.
Right, so what you're saying is, you haven't had to sort of accommodate things around, that move things around the rug to make the room actually less ergonomic.
No, there was
it's not made the room worse.
There was an active need for the rug, and the rug has fulfilled that need.
In many ways, the rug is the holding, is the Declan Rice that Manchester United didn't get,
yes,
isn't it?
It is exactly that.
Kaiser says, given the choice, which footballer would you choose to bite your toenail? Sam says, if you had to have your toe sucked by one of the class of 92, who would it be? Joe, if you could chew anyone's toenails, dead or alive, who would it be? This is the slightly interesting video, Barry. I don't know why I'm coming to you, of Paul Scholes biting the toenails of his daughter. I don't have children. Actually, Barney is the only father here. So, Barney, when your children cut their toenails, do you make them do it themselves or do you bite them off for them?
Well, I've got two teenage boys.
Yes.
The idea is, kind of absolutely horrifying. You see, parents do this when their kids are really small. I thought this was about him doing it to a toddler or a tiny baby. And then his daughter is 20 years old. It's, maybe it's normal. Maybe she has a problem with their toenails. I think I'm not going to criticize someone else's parenting. They're very close and that's very nice.
Which member of the class of 92 would you go for, Baz? Neville would probably would gnaw at it.
Neville would do a very thorough job.
That's true.
He'd practice really hard on someone else's toes first.
And analyse it. He'd spend hours and hours and then analyse it with Jamie Carragher for a whole hour on how he did it.
I must say, I did enjoy Jamie Carragher and Graham Souness's very playful, bordering on bullying, ribbing of Gary Neville in the post-match, post-mortem. That was quite fun.
But it is interesting that they won't... I saw you tweeting about it, Barney, that his former teammates are sort of more polite to him. Kaza Boo-Boo says, what's worse than a coach's mate as a pundit? Apparently, on Israeli TV, former Derby County player Avi Nimni, who's now an agent, gives his opinion on his own client's performance without saying he's their agent. Just says they were brilliant, regardless of what happens. A footballing question before we leave this from Phil Williams, the Times radio presenter, who said, do any of you know when to press and who says go and how many of us should take part in the press? Thank you. Wilson.
Well, I think it's probably very dependent team to team, but there will be certain triggers that the players will be coached in. So one of the things Barcelona were very good at was, as soon as you lose possession, can you win it back straight away? Because in that moment of the opponent taking the ball off you, their head is likely to be down. They're not likely to have awareness of where other players are on the pitch because they've just won the ball. There'll also be an expenditure of energy, so maybe they're... there's a fraction of sluggishness you can take advantage of. So that would be a trigger. If, for instance, somebody plays, I don't know, a square pass or a defender gets the ball with his facing his own goal, that could be a time when you do it. So there'll be a series of triggers that become sort of semi-automated. There will be times when a player will shout and then how many go? Well, again, it depends where on the pitch you are. It depends how many passing lanes you need to close down. I think you'd have specific plans for specific games. So there was a Liverpool game at Southampton about 3 years ago, I think, where Liverpool pretty much scored directly from Southampton kickoff. They obviously knew exactly where the ball was going. They knew what Southampton did from the kickoff. And suddenly they all pounced as one. And that was clearly they'd looked at how Southampton kicked off and they triggered that action. So
yeah, they practice it. It's not some sort of random idea. Like, I think suggestion from the question is that, you know, it's something you sort of instinctively know or something. But Guardiola will move players around on the training, but, you know, spend hours doing this. He painted a spot where he wanted Raheem Sterling to stand at one point with chalk in a certain phase because he was so frustrated by him not being in the right space. It's just meticulousness and hard work. And I don't know if you can coach it mid-season. You probably can't. There's no time. But it's totally coached, and these are rhythms that they learn, and they do shout, because you could particularly hear that when there were no fans in the stadiums, you'd hear people sort of saying now or go, or, you know,
I think different players can take on board different amounts of information. So you know, Mason Mount is a player that every coach talks about being brilliant at just understanding the shape of the game. So I don't know, but I assume at Chelsea he'd be very dominant in leading that. Certain other players I think find it very difficult, but they will know, for instance, when the right side of centre back has the ball, you block up the passageway between him and the right back, stop him playing that pass. That's all your job is. So I think for some players it's quite simple, for some it's very complicated. He's a bit like a bay leaf in that he's absolutely essential to the recipe, but it's quite hard for an outsider to tell what he does. But if you don't have him in there, you really taste the difference.
Sure, but if you eat him, it's also really unpleasant.
Yeah, that is true. No chewing Mason Mount's toes, because you will get terrible indigestion.
Sort of a silly point, regard, but and yet it sort of speaks volumes of the difference about how we think of the game, that I don't bother putting bay leaves in a stew anymore because I'm not sure what they do.
Well, they're very 70s bay leaves, aren't they? Aren't we a bit post-bay leaf these days?
You're saying Frank Worthington was more of a bay leaf than...
Frank Worthington clearly wasn't a bay leaf. He's the least bay leafy player I can think of.
Who's the most bay leafy player?
Well, Mason Mount.
Okay.
Mason Mount. Gary Bay leaf.
Dennis Bay leaf, who was the... last player to score a hat-trick in the league at Old Trafford.
He was.
QPR.
Are we just saying Bayleaf, Peacock, Farrell? Are we just saying Bayleaf?
Right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Goodison. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Everton 2, Watford 5. Richard Jolly's stat. Watford's last five Premier League away wins have come under five different managers. Gracia, Sanchez, Flores, Pearson, Munoz, Ranieri. Josh King was amazing, said Ranieri. Not only for the hat-trick, but it was amazing how he holds the ball and fights the centre-backs. Josh King said, I had a feeling when I woke up today I was going to score. I had a bit of a point to prove after last season. I found it very hard to make any sense of this football match. Can any of you oblige?
No.
So what, Everton just sort of... Everton defensively disappeared, Barry, in this game.
Yeah, there was... Ben Godfrey and Keane had very bad games. I don't know if each poor performance sort of prompted the other, but they were uncharacteristically poor. It was a weird capitulation by Everton, and one I think we probably thought Rafa Benitez had ironed that out of the Everton psyche, but I suppose this being innate Everton, it'll take him longer than he has been there so far. But it was a brilliant performance by Watford. I mean, they had played well already this season, albeit against Norwich, but yeah, it was, and considering how bad they were against Liverpool last week, it's a remarkable training performance by Claudio Ranieri to whip them into that kind of shape in, I don't know what, four training sessions, five. And, you know, I think we all had them relegated after the Everton game or the Liverpool game, and we thought Ranieri might not last till Christmas, and on the evidence of that performance, they'll comfortably stay up. So I don't know. They've made fools of me, certainly, and quite a lot of other people, I think.
Marcus, do they have more points than Man United? They're almost up with Man United, aren't they, in terms of points now? They're quite close, maybe one win off. There were weird goals in that game, goals that look wrong, where they're just too close to the goal and somehow there's no defenders and you're doing sort of bits of skill around the centre half. It was sort of Sunday League-ish. So there was something transgressive about it.
But Michael Keane was just far too deep all the time. I don't quite know how that happens. I mean, obviously, Everton had a huge problem in that Mina Doucouré and Calvert-Lewin are all out, so that's their spine gone. But not having a spine doesn't mean you have to be quite as spineless as that.
I mean, you're right. That one Josh King goal where he just sort of, the ball ended up with him and there was just, you were watching it as a football fan thinking that is definitely, that happens on the park and it doesn't happen in the Premier League, but it did happen. Let's go to Stamford Bridge, Chelsea 7, Norwich 0. Email from Michael Shreve. Hi all, did Biff hand Max the sports almanac? The Mason Mount as triple captain advice was inspired. David says, thanks to Max for his FPL advice to triple captain Mason Mount this week. When should I play my bench boost? I have no idea what any of this means, but apparently Lars Sivertsen dismissed my idea and he was wrong to do so because the Bayleaf himself scored a hat trick, didn't he? I mean, this game, Barney, was sort of bleak for Norwich, but in a way, it seems fine. Like no one, even Daniel Farke was saying, this isn't the match, this isn't the game that defines us. It's Chelsea they were going to beat us anyway.
Well, Daniel Farke is incredibly reassuring. He's that guy who you're literally dying and he'll be explaining to you how, you know, it's really remarkable that everything's kind of fine and you'll be okay. This is a remarkable illness you have. You know, it's great. But he just seems so relentlessly upbeat. It was interesting that obviously the interesting thing about this game is that Chelsea without Lukaku starting look like we expected them to look this season. That hasn't really worked as a signing. I think it's kind of fair, pretty obvious to say. After that kind of early hysteria, the final piece in the jigsaw, you know, we heard it so many times. I don't know what kind of jigsaw this is that only that piece will kind of work. But he appears to not be the final piece in the jigsaw. He appears to be the wrong piece entirely, kind of. And maybe he's not really a Tuchel player. I don't know whose fault it is that he hasn't really integrated into the system. You always kind of feel it's the manager's fault, but it just doesn't work. Too often, I've watched Chelsea quite a lot, and often Lukaku's basically watching his teammates kind of knitting a jumper. He's just stood there watching this passing happening behind him. And he wants to be really involved in the game. He wants to be used as a wall, the ball bouncing off him, people running past. And that's not how that Chelsea team is ever really going to play. And it presents a fascinating dilemma.
That's interesting, because I sort of hadn't spotted that. I presumed he'd scored some goals and he was doing fine. And you know, Chelsea weren't playing brilliantly, but were winning games. But I suppose this weekend shows that, I mean, it was only Norwich, but they had a fluency perhaps that they haven't had in recent weeks.
Yeah, they did also win the the Champions League without a centre forward. Like, obviously, there's something in that system and in those players that works with what Tuchel wants to do. And there's been some criticism of Kai Havertz hasn't been playing very well, but I think the position that he had played best in last season is that kind of false nine hasn't really existed this year. So that's possibly a part of it. It'll be really interesting to see how they go. It's not that Lukaku's not a brilliant player. He obviously is. But I think he was maybe a bit overpraised in the first couple of weeks as though he's this kind of, you know, all-time, you know, player who can just slot into that team and immediately improve them. And it's kind of almost reassuring that football's not that simple and it doesn't work that easily. There are lots more variables.
Barry, Norwich have not scored many times this season.
Yeah, our supply producer / presenter Melissa is a Norwich season ticket holder, and last week she showed me a betting slip on the 22nd of May, which was presumably around the time they got promoted. She put a tenner on Norwich to score less than 20 Premier League goals this season. Which is a remarkable show of faith in her team. So far, they've got 2 from 9 games, so she's bang on course to win 2 grand for herself, which might ease the pain of what looks like inevitable relegation. But I had a look yesterday, just out of curiosity, to see how many players Norwich had brought in over the summer, because I didn't think there were many. And I apologise to Norwich fans, they're a team I don't pay a huge amount of attention to. But they brought in 10 outfield players, including Billy Gilmore, who wasn't allowed to play against his parent club on Saturday. And he's probably the best of those. Well, he is, without question, the best of them. But 6 of them started the game against Chelsea. 2 of them came on as subs. And they're patently just not good enough. You know, they sold Emi Buendia and they reinvested the money they got for him in, you know, sort of buying around, you know, £5 to £10 million players, loads of them. And they're just clearly not up to the task.
It's just odd that Norwich and Watford were the 2 teams promoted automatically, and Watford obviously had a very good day on Saturday, and maybe they will survive. But the fact that Brentford, who only came up through the playoffs, who were worse than Norwich and Watford last season, not only have they sort of adapted to the Premier League much better, but I think everybody sort of expected them to as well. And I don't know, I find that quite a difficult thing to explain and conceptualise for why that should be, that style of football should work in the Premier League better than it does in the Championship.
It's a good question. If only we had some people who had the answers, but we don't.
I'm more worried about Barry's sleeve, which, as he kind of wiped his face in kind of long-suffering early morning, kind of, oh, I've got to have food. I could see you'd clearly been either burnt or discoloured in some way, and I'm worried you've put that down on a hot plate or maybe on your gas hob.
I'm not sure if it's a burn or paint or whatever, but it's sort of a big red stain on the cuff of my jumper.
Have you been painting
sleeve.
Anything recently or burning anything recently?
I have been painting something, but I've painted it green, so it's not that.
Yeah, it's a deep red, isn't it? Is this the point where the narrator says Glendenning somehow escaped detection for years, despite colleagues having... I'm sure it's not the big red stain is nothing. It's nothing. It's nothing. Probably a burn or something.
I'd be really let down if Barry was a murderer. You know, the following pod would be tricky. Would we bring it up, or would we brush it under the carpet? What do you think?
We'd apologise if anyone was offended, wouldn't we? Isn't that what you do?
You're absolutely right. We didn't know. Now we're everyone is an accomplice to. The Glendenning murders. Ah, anyway, to Brighton, who lost 4-1 at home to Manchester City. When they break at pace, Wilson, it is exhilarating, isn't it? I mean, the 2 Foden goals, the one that he scored and the one that just accidentally hit him on the way in, were just so fast. It's a different game.
Yeah, I mean, they're really good. I think they're a little bit lucky in the sense that the first goal, I think, was probably a foul on the keeper, but yeah, they're clearly the better side. I think Brighton are struggling without Bissouma. That early season form has dipped away a bit. But second half, yeah, they still played pretty well, Brighton. So, I mean, it wasn't a particularly dramatic or exciting game, but I thought it was quite a high-quality game.
Mm-hmm. Andrew says, is Manchester City having the club's name rather than the club badge on their away shirt the start of a new trend? And if so, how do we stop this heinous crime against football ever happening again?
It is a new trend, isn't it? There's a whole load of Puma kits.
Do young people hate badges? Nobody. Is badges just a legacy fan? The crest is just a legacy fan thing?
Well, I mean, legacy stuff seems quite popular in Manchester, so stick a badge on it and people will support it, won't they?
Do you want me to carry on with these questions, Wilson, or just move on?
I find it frankly bewildering you've come to me on a question of fashion.
Well, I mean, I've got someone who hasn't even washed the jumper that he murdered someone in. I suppose I could have come to Barney, but I didn't necessarily see him. So I've not got a lot to work with here, have I? You know, I can't just... Jean-Paul Gaultier is not on the other screen. I can't just flash across and go to Alexa Chung.
I'm wearing a free T-shirt and a 25-year-old jumper.
Barney?
Well, it's hardly the most pressing issue facing the games. I mean, I suppose it's a visible emblem of various things that have gone wrong. I mean, quite a lot of the old badges are terrible. The people didn't really have software to design things, you know, back in the day. And there's a lot of weird kind of things, you know, castle walls and stuff, the badly drawn animals. So why not have some sleek modern design, Max?
Have you seen Barnsley's badge? I'm sure Barnsley used to have like a head of a dog. And then they seem to have gone to a very old, I don't know when this changed, if indeed it has changed. I mean, I haven't researched this at all. But their badge, I noticed relatively recently, they've got, I think it's a miner and a glassblower on the badge, which is very nice, I think.
Okay.
Not enough glassblowers on badges.
No, well,
or maybe it's the right amount. I mean, yeah, who else does glass apart from Barnes?
You don't want how many, what's the, any more than two. And then, you know, I think probably that is.
Yeah, Sunderland was a big centre of glass blowing.
Was it?
Well, we were the St. Peter's, where Venable B grew up. It was the first church in England to have stained glass windows.
Have you done much glass blowing yourself? Is it something that all young
you can go to the, we went on, I remember being taken from school to on a glass blowing trip. It's hard.
I mean, pod merch. I mean, glasses, like, you know, glass things blown by Jonathan Wilson, I think would sell.
This, I've just got a penny. Kind of, I've got a fast forward sort of view of what it'd be like to go on a date with Wilson. That's kind of owl sanctuary territory, like.
That or Pushkas. Anyway, Brentford 1, Leicester 2. Third win in a week for Leicester. Goal of the weekend was from this game. Ethan Pinnock was on the pitch, Barry, but it wasn't him. What a hit from Youri Tielemans. Michael says, please confirm whether Tielemans' goal was a half volley or not. I'm saying yes, just. No?
Ooh.
Oh.
That's interesting now you mention it. Watching it this morning, it didn't occur to me that it was a half volley, but
well, it bounced more.
Maybe it was.
It bounced more than once, and I was very, very sure of myself about half volleys. I feel a pure half volley is on the first bent bounce.
Yeah, I didn't recognise it as a half volley. I'll have to have another look.
Okay.
But this you know, it was a good game. I thought it would be. Brentford, for the second game in a row, were very unlucky to come away with nothing, but. Thomas Frank doesn't, you know, seem chipper enough after it. You could excuse him for feeling exasperated at coming, you know, putting his team putting in two such excellent performances in a row and not winning even a point. But I think they'll be fine. I mean, they're a very good, well organised, well drilled team. They're everything Manchester United are not, making the best of limited resources, whereas Manchester United have incredible resources and aren't using them well at all.
That'll do for part two. Part three, begin at the Emirates. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Arsenal 3, Villa 1. Villa didn't manage a shot in the first half. First time since May 2018 that's happened to a team playing against Arsenal in the league. They were rubbish in that 45. I saw lots of people, Wilson, saying this was breathtaking and scintillating from Arsenal, and I thought they were just okay against a team that really weren't very good.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. I don't really understand Villa, because I saw them at Tottenham, when was that, 3 weeks ago? Mm-hmm. 3 games ago, and they were coming off the back of getting the win at Old Trafford, and so I thought of, you know, Villa were quite good, and they were terrible against Tottenham, and it was a similar thing. Everybody go, oh yeah, Nuno's got Tottenham playing properly. And I was watching, this is just a crap game of football. And I sort of felt that on Friday, that, I mean, Arsenal clearly were a lot better than Villa. And given where Arsenal were at the start of the season, I think that's clearly a step in the right direction. But I just don't trust Arsenal at the minute. I'm not convinced this is necessarily going to last. I don't really understand what's happened with Villa. I only saw the highlights, so it's never easy to tell. But that game against Wolves, it sounded like and looked like they were much the better team the first 80 minutes, and they suddenly let in three. So I don't quite know what's going on there.
Crystal Palace 1, Newcastle 1. I thought this game, Barry, was a lot about Christian Benteke either missing very simple chances or scoring really good headers, whether they were allowed or disallowed.
Yeah, that's certainly one strand of it. I suppose on another level, it was Newcastle's first game without Steve Bruce in charge, They were very lucky to get a draw. There was no obvious sign of improvement under Graham Jones. Obviously, he can't work miracles in a very short space of time, even though Thomas Tuchel can sort out the Chelsea defence and press in one training session. But Newcastle were pretty poor, and Palace are throwing away a lot of points. But they also, you know, sort of in Brentford terms, they look pretty decent as well, even though they're not winning games.
Yeah, they look organised. They look like they have a plan. They look like they know what they're doing. And I think, I don't know about you, Barney, Vieira has impressed me. I wasn't expecting him to get Palace as organised as this.
Yeah. I didn't really... I think I'd probably prematurely kind of written him off as a in his early managerial days as a bit of a kind of celebrity. One of these people who has such standing in the game that they'll get a managerial job on the stage. It's funny enough, I heard one of the stewards just there. I was walking out at Old Trafford. I heard one of the stewards talking about Patrick Vieira. He's a sort of oldish, very Mancunian guy who's saying, you know, when I used to work at City, they were talking about Solskjaer and a sort of lack of presence, saying, when I worked at City, Vieira, you knew he was coming. You knew he was coming a minute off. You knew he was in the building. You knew he was coming. And I went, why is that? And he said, he smelled absolutely gorgeous. I was expecting more to say, you know, presence, you know, just that. But apparently he smelled, you know, absolutely a delicious smell that preceded him.
I remember doing a phone-in about, you know, footballers who you had smelt, and probably with you, Barry, and the best call was somebody who had flown to Milan for a business meeting and had walked into a cafe, and Alessandro Del Piero was in the cafe, and he had so much cologne on, the man who'd gone to Milan for an important business meeting got a migraine and couldn't go to his business meeting because of just the sheer stench of Del Piero. That was just too much. Anyway, Callum Wilson bicycle kick, Sinclair Spectrum rating from Ryan. That's what he wanted. I gave it a 5.4. It was a wonderful finish, but it wasn't from a cross. So you can't get that many points. You look disappointed in that, Wilson.
I'm not convinced it was a bicycle kick. But then I kind of remember just how boring the half volley composition was, and so I tried to stop myself.
Police are carrying out inquiries into a banner unveiled by Crystal Palace fans before the game, depicting an image of the club's Saudi Arabian owners about to behead a magpie as faceless fans in the background saying, "We've got our club back." A statement by the Holmesdale fanatics, that the set of Crystal Palace fans who sit behind that goal or stand behind that goal, said the Premier League had chosen money over morals in allowing the takeover, adding it had done business with one of the world's most bloody and repressive regimes. To give the thumbs up to the deal at a time when the Premier League is promoting the women's game and inclusive initiatives such as rainbow armbands and rainbow laces shows the total hypocrisy at play. Croydon Metropolitan Police said officers are assessing the information and carrying out inquiries. Any allegations of racist abuse will be taken very seriously. There was another banner from Newcastle fans saying, "Until Amanda, I was never happy," with a big picture of Amanda Staveley on it. As we've mentioned before, the Premier League said they've received legally binding assurances that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia will not control Newcastle United Football Club. Lee says, "Given how quickly we've all moved on re Newcastle, should we just embrace state-owned teams, get a proper Super League going, North Korea buying Norwich, El Salvador buying Southampton with Bitcoin, etc.?" I asked Johnny Liu this on Thursday. I'm interested to know, Barney and Wilson, your thoughts about how we should continue to cover this story.
Don't think we have moved on, have we? We're literally talking about it now.
I haven't moved on. I've moved on in a way. I find it really difficult to write about this or talk about it because I just find it so completely depressing. There's a nihilism about it. It's as though people are really scared or unable to say that something is right or wrong. And I've sort of felt this about our world increasingly. Like, we just get lost in this miasma of bullshit. So, yes, there are other things which are wrong. There are other people who are undesirable. There are other degrees of things that we might not like. But this is such a nakedly cynical move by people who want to manipulate you, who aren't very nice. And we seem to have no confidence in the ability to say that there's any other way of making things better for you. The fans who welcome this, who embrace it, who say, what about Uber? We're sort of people. I keep reading articles where people say, well, they're just football fans. What do they know? They can't possibly be expected to make a moral judgment. They've suffered under Mike Ashley for so long that the football's been not quite as good as they would have liked. And I just find this absolutely gutless and pathetic. Of course, these people can make a moral judgment. We're really giving up on people. We're really saying that we as a society are so uneducated and have so little confidence in ourselves that we're not willing to say, I think this thing is wrong, just because some other people can say, well, what about this? What about that? And I think it's a real problem. And I think it's a sign that we've all been beaten down for far too long. And this has just been waved through by the same football governing body, which purports to talk about morality and preaches at us about things and has done pretty much for the last year and a half, including the Super League. And I just find it very depressing that we've reached this point. And you can write as many articles as you like about how people should feel about this, but they don't seem to get us anywhere. But I don't think we should stop mentioning it. And I'm sorry if saying these things has upset people, but the kind of moral relativism around it is just so vapid and vacuous. I think we should all be quite worried about it.
Barney's right. It is moral relativism. But the problem with moral relativism is you end up where the only crime is hypocrisy. But, you know, we're all hypocrites. Yeah, you can't not be. But you can cut all that aside and say, are you okay with torture? And if you are, well, fine. Get on with kind of wearing your headdress and celebrating Saudi Arabia taking over your club. If you think that's probably not great, have some reservations.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just interested in, do we do it every podcast? Like every time we talk about Newcastle? Because I wrote a piece saying, look, I've let it slip with City. And I looked at what Amnesty are saying about the human rights abuses in Abu Dhabi at the moment. And I don't talk about them. We didn't talk about them, the City-Brighton result, 5 minutes ago, because their takeover was so long ago.
Well, we have a limited amount of time, Max. Some people with clipboards and lab coats have decided that podcast ideal length is between 50 and 70 minutes, and after that people start to get bored, and they're probably going to get bored if 10 minutes of that content every week is about human rights in Saudi Arabia. But
there's valuable time when we could be talking about Bayleaf Peacock Farrell. I mean, there's a lot of filler, there's quite a lot of padding.
But if we highlight the moral shortcomings, or if we feel compelled to highlight the moral shortcomings of every club owner that whose club is mentioned, that is going to take up in every podcast, that is going to take up an awful lot of time. There have been work-related discussions and meetings about how will we cover the World Cup in Qatar? How, you have to cover the football, but you also have to cover the noise around the football and the deaths that them hosting the football has caused. You can't mention it in every single match report of every group game and knockout game in the next World Cup, but it would be a dereliction of duty not to cover it. And actually, a lot of Newcastle fans have used this as a sort of stick to beat journalists who've highlighted human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia, saying, oh, well, presumably then you won't be covering the World Cup in Qatar. And that would be ludicrous not to cover it. You have to cover it just because it's an unpleasant, unseemly business doesn't mean you don't.
I mean, that's an idiotic comment, because you cover it in order to highlight the fact that there are parts of it which are undesirable. If you don't cover it, no one will be saying that. I think that's a misunderstanding of what journalism is. It's not just a freebie trip to the football. You go where the news is. I mean, that's just a non-point. We're highlighting the fact that why this World Cup is being staged there. That's why we're covering the World Cup.
Talking of unpleasant and unseemly things, West Ham 1-0 Tottenham. this was a terrible football match, I thought. West Ham up to fourth on 17 points. Moyes' best start to a season since 04-05 with Everton. Johnny Lou seemed to say Antonio didn't do a whole lot and Harry Kane at times looked bright. And I just couldn't disagree more with that. I thought the difference was basically two teams not really doing a whole lot. Harry Kane really wasn't at it and Antonio was. And he got the goal because Harry Kane wasn't concentrating at a corner. I mean, that is oversimplifying a really boring game of football. But that was my view, Wilson.
Yeah. I mean, it was... The problem was it was happening at the same time as the T20 World Cup and was less interesting. So I was flicking over to that. So I missed large parts of it. But what I saw was it was a terrible game and Antonio got the goal. So fair play to him.
People suggesting that Tottenham Man United is known as El Sacchio, possibly.
You can't sack Nuno this soon, can they? I mean, this looks an awful fit. But... You can't get rid of somebody in what would be the beginning of November, can you? I mean,
it doesn't seem like any of it's really his fault as well. You got a Spurs team there that just kind of reached the end of its time. They Pochettino, but the bones of it are still there, and it's not been properly refreshed. I mean, he is so devoid of energy. It's kind of astonishing, though. I mean, he's so damp and cold and sad, and he's no longer a sad dying Jedi. He's the man who's just going to tell you that your car has died or the boiler is finished, but really sympathetically in a way where you don't really blame him. And then he mooch off in his anorak back out into the rain. I mean, he's so sad and melancholy. I feel like he's just covered in moss. I don't know if he's the man.
He wasn't always like this, though, was he?
No, he had a kind of quiet authority before. Yeah, he had a kind of presence. But the Spurs thing just seems to have turned him into a kind of, ancient medieval warrior who's kind of been resurrected out of his tomb to talk about loneliness and death and the cold.
And to go around telling people their fridges are broken.
I'm lost on this, buddy. He's not only he's a medieval corpse that's come back from the dead, and he's also he's also my mechanic.
Yeah, he's got a combi curse.
No wonder he's melancholic. If he's gone down the job centre, what skills have you got? Chivalry. I'm really good at chivalry. Right. Boiler repairs?
This is actually a success story. He's retrained.
As he slides, you go to the garage and then, he unwheels, he wheels from under the car and he's in chain mail. Nuno, why are you in chain
mail? With a broadsword.
I have many other things that he is.
I think it's the alternator. Yeah, why are you doing that with a mace?
Why are you fiddling with a car when you ride a horse?
Yeah.
Do you know anything about cars?
Would you like to talk about death for a bit? There's many other things that Nuno is. I could go on.
He's a bit like the knight in Indiana Jones and the Holy Grail.
Yes.
He's been there for so long.
He's got minding the selection of goblets and chalices.
That's the "you chose poorly" guy.
What? Exactly, yeah. The other two games, Southampton 2, Burnley 2, and Leeds 1, Wolves 1. Any things you spotted from these games?
Mini shout out, Max, to Joe Gerhardt, who came on as a sub for Leeds and looked absolutely fantastic. 19-year-old Scouse kid who I'd never heard of before.
Mm. And also Maxwell Cornet, who scored an absolute bullet, didn't he, for Burnley. And he's a bit of fun. And it was disappointing to see Rav Hasenhüttl with a coat over his waistcoat. And then he took it off. And then literally as he took it off, Livramento scored. So that is the secret. Look, we'll discuss David Beckham, £150 million and Qatar later this week. Tris says, did the Bazinator meet those people on Friday night?
No, the Bazinator was otherwise engaged.
Okay. Hello to Mike, an Irishman who lives in Portland, who's listening to this out on his run. a new listener. I just presumed we were steadily losing the old one. So this is exciting, exciting news. And this one is from Steve, who says, "Dear Max and team, given that an HGV driver just reversed his rig into Bristol docks, let's face it, not an inconspicuous feature of the landscape, unlike, say, reversing over a random cat. Does Barry feel vindicated, fact-checked or not, that the operating of an HGV going backwards should remain part of the official test and not offloaded to some ancillary authority and therefore inevitably leading to the sort of mayhem that Barry was worried about? From sunny Los Angeles, happily free of truckers who can't reliably back up. Keep up the good work."
Oh, I absolutely feel vindicated. Just to go back to something we were discussing earlier, You were wondering what you would do if it turns out I'm a murderer.
Yes, of course.
Now, I'm not saying I am or am not a murderer. Yeah. I might be. Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah.
But you could do a really good spin-off true crime podcast, you know, because we have all these murder podcasts.
That's true. And they're popular.
A podcast about a podcast that had a murderer on it.
Really,
and
good.
How did we not know?
Would you do your one weekly phone call as the pod? Like, would it be like, boo, boo.
Well,
you have 40 minutes.
I presumably you'd have to build up to it and then I'd appear on the last one.
No, but I'm meaning, would you do Football Weekly still?
I'm not sure it would be a great look for the Guardian, but I would be willing to do it.
I think rehabilitation is very much within the Guardian's wheelhouse.
Also, if I'm in jail,
yeah,
I'm not going to have access to the football.
Do you not get Match of the Day in jail?
I think you get Match of the Day in jail.
Oh, I think you can watch Match of the Day, yeah.
Yeah, I think you can. I'm slightly worried about the tweets, though. You know, it's all well and good you talking about these human rights abuses. One quarter of your panel murdered someone in cold blood, and yet it's still on.
Well, yeah, judging by recent events, we'd have people in the streets celebrating the return of Barry.
Posters of Barry.
We've got our pod back. Yeah.
Sure, he killed someone, but look, we need his hot taker. We need someone to say, "I don't really follow that team too closely, but anyway, this is what I thought about them." Right, that'll do for today. Thank you, Wilson.
Thank you.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Cheers, Barney.
Cheers, Barry.
Back for a Europod tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.